I have the pleasure today of talking with Dr. Mark Johnston, who came to Lancaster about 3 years ago and joined the Lancaster Gastroenterology Group. Most of you know the senior partners as Dave Weston and Fred Saunders, just to help orient you as to which group Mark is with. Mark, welcome.
Well, thank you.
You have had a very interesting background that I'd like to just summarize briefly. Having been born in Salt Lake City, Utah, and followed your physician father around the country, and eventually ending up in the Mid-Atlantic, where you graduated from Penn State and Hahnemann Medical School, and then joined the Navy, and really did see the world, as their phrase goes, because you, in addition to your naval duties, we've been talking earlier about how you got interested in the work that was being done in Albania by some missionaries after Albania opened up to the West. That was in 91 that
91,
they opened up.
Right.
And you started getting involved there in 94.
Correct. Yeah.
But perhaps at another time we'll have a chance to go into that. If we started down that fascinating road, I know that we would quickly spend half an hour. And today we want to really talk about clinical things. So we're going to talk primarily about your interest in and development of a treatment for Barrett's esophagus. And I would like to start by just asking you to define for us what Barrett's esophagus really is.
Barrett's esophagus is a change in the lining of the esophagus, believed to be caused by acid reflux, so that the normal squamous lining gets completely replaced as a result of injury with a different kind of tissue called specialized intestinal metaplasia. To have Barrett's, what you simply need is to have that kind of tissue replacing the normal lining. And so any length of that in the esophagus constitutes Barrett's esophagus. And it's important because that tissue is the kind of tissue that leads to adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, which happens to be the fastest rising in incidence cancer in the United States. Not the most prevalent, but the most rapidly rising in incidence in the Western world.
Not the most prevalent because it starts from a very low base.
Right.
But it's increasing. Why? Do we know why?
We don't know why. However, we know that it's directly correlated with the obesity epidemic. And so probably epidemiologically, most people think it's the obesity epidemic which has a correlation with acid reflux.
Well, and just to complete that thought, obesity increases intra-abdominal pressure, increases gastroesophageal reflux.
Exactly right.
What are the risks of a Barrett's esophagus turning into a carcinoma?
Fortunately, the risk is relatively low. If you're an average American, 14% of the average American population has acid reflux. Fairly prevalent condition.
That's approximately one out of seven people.
Exactly right. Of those 14% who have acid reflux, those who have chronic reflux, that's several times a week, about 20% of them will have Barrett's esophagus.
So one out of five people with gastroesophageal reflux
could have Barrett's
could
of
have
some
Barrett's
length.
Esophagus.
Those people with Barrett's, there's about a 5 to 10% lifetime risk of getting esophageal cancer. So a good correlation is the average American's risk for colon cancer is 6%, or close to 5%. So one out of 20 Americans will get colon cancer. A little more than one out of 20 Americans with Barrett's will get esophageal cancer. So about 5%, at most 10% of patients with Barrett's will get adenocarcinoma of the esophagus in their lifetime. So the majority will not.
But still in all,
that's a pretty high risk.
5 to 10%. Once you find Barrett's esophagus in a person, they have a 5 to 10% chance of developing a cancer.
In their lifetime, that's correct.
I think that puts it in perspective. Does that mean then that anyone with gastroesophageal reflux should at some point have an esophagoscopy to be sure that they are not developing Barrett's esophagus?
That's a great question, because if you take the average American, we tell everybody if you're over 50, you need a colonoscopy, and then you need one periodically the rest of your life, depending on what's found. The same applies for people with heartburn. Current guidelines are anyone that's 50 or older who's had any degree of heartburn, no matter how mild, that means an episode of burning relieved with a little bit of Mylanta once a week, should at least once in their life have an upper endoscopy to look for the presence or absence of Barrett's esophagus. The fortunate thing is, if you don't have Barrett's at that time, you don't need to have endoscopies every 10 years like a colonoscopy. If you don't have Barrett's at age 50, you're not likely to ever get Barrett's, providing you maintain control of your acid reflux. So everyone, even with mild symptoms, should at least have a one-time endoscopy looking for the presence or absence of Barrett's.
At age 50?
Well, that's published guidelines. What most people would say is any adult who has chronic heartburn, and that means more than several episodes per week, beginning at any age, even your late teens, you should check them for at least once for the presence or absence of Barrett's via endoscopy. And it's important to note, this diagnosis can't be made via upper GI, can't be made with any other modality apart from physically looking, identifying the change, and then confirming its presence with a biopsy.
Once one has identified Barrett's esophagus in a person with gastroesophageal reflux, because that's our understanding of the disease, how does one proceed?
The new guidelines just came out last month, March, from the American College of Gastroenterology of how to approach this. And their commentary was, since this is a lifetime plan, anybody diagnosed with Barrett's really needs to sit down with their physician to decide whether or not they're going to pursue surveillance, because surveillance is a lifetime commitment to search for the precancerous or cancerous lesion. So number one is initial therapy, once someone's diagnosed with Barrett's, is to decide whether or not they're going to get routine surveillance endoscopies the rest of their life.
Because why would they not?
Actually, if you ask me, I would say it'd be crazy not to. But what's up for discussion is, does surveillance unequivocally reduce your chances of getting esophageal cancer? And if it is picked up early, does that really change the natural history of the disease? There's no randomized controlled trial that's demonstrated that, and there never will be, because no one will ever stratify a control group where they don't get surveillance, because it'd be unethical. But there are over 9 published studies that have looked at people who are in surveillance and those who are not, and we found out as people who are in surveillance clearly have their disease picked up earlier and clearly live longer. And so with retrospective studies and studies that have looked at patients followed, clearly there's a benefit. So from my point of view as a gastroenterologist, unequivocally, if you have Barrett's and you have a reasonable life expectancy, you should definitely undergo surveillance endoscopy. So what's that? The current guidelines are, once a diagnosis of Barrett's has been established by endoscopy and biopsy, and it's a new diagnosis, they should have a repeat endoscopy in 1 year with biopsies. And then if there is no dysplasia on either of those two endoscopies, then they should have an endoscopy every 3 years the rest of their life, looking for the development of dysplasia or frank adenocarcinoma esophagus.
Now let's just explain to non-pathologists what we mean by dysplasia.
So basically, what's the continuum from the normal esophagus to adenocarcinoma of the esophagus? The continuum is normal esophagus lined by squamous epithelium, then acid injury, healing by placement of that normal squamous with what's called specialized intestinal metaplasia, which is columnar cells with goblet cells interspersed. That change is associated with a 60 to 100-fold increased risk of adenocarcinoma. And then from that point forward, the next cancer stage is what's called low-grade dysplasia. And then the next stage is high-grade dysplasia. And then the next stage is adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. And as it turns out, there's an accumulation of genetic abnormalities, P53 mutations, and all kinds of things, that accumulate throughout that continuum to the point that you ultimately develop cancer. We recommend different intervals of surveillance based on the degree of dysplasia a patient has on a biopsy. So, for example, if you have no dysplasia confirmed on two endoscopies within a year of initial diagnosis, you can
then
be done every
3 years.
If you have low-grade dysplasia, the new guidelines say that you should have a repeat endoscopy every 6 months until either that dysplasia is gone or it's progressed to high-grade dysplasia. If you have high-grade dysplasia, the standard guidelines call for an intervention. And the interventions are ablation, and there are many types of ablation, a whole other discussion, we can touch that in a minute, or surgery. And surgery is an esophagectomy. And certainly Dr. Bonchak can talk about an esophagectomy and what that really means for an individual. But 10 years ago, the standard of care for high-grade dysplasia in Barrett's esophagus was an esophagectomy if they were deemed a reasonable mm-hmm. candidate for that operation. Mm-hmm. In 2008, that is not really regarded as the standard of care anymore. The standard of care in 2008 is probably ablation, and we can quote some recent literature to support that position. In fact, there's a neat large article that has compared esophagectomy and ablation and found them to be fairly equal in the treatment of high-grade dysplasia. So surveillance is based on degree of dysplasia. There are different intervals of surveillance depending on the degree of dysplasia. And the main time to intervene, which is agreed upon by most experts, is at the level of high-grade dysplasia or worse.
Now, we've talked about ablation as a recommended approach. How does one ablate a Barrett's endothelium?
There are many different ways to ablate Barrett's epithelium. The grandfather of ablation techniques is a thing called photodynamic therapy, PDT. PDT works, but it has significant limitations. What PDT is injecting an individual with a drug called Photofrin. This drug radically sensitizes tissue to a specific wavelength of light. It happens to be 630 nanometers, and that's a laser wavelength of light. You inject the patient with this drug. 2 days later, after the injection of Photofrin, they come back to the endoscopy lab. An endoscope is placed down. A fiber optic fiber is placed through the endoscope, and a specific wavelength of laser light is emitted to basically irradiate the Barrett's. And then it sloughs off. They all get chest pain. 30 to 50% of folks treated this way will develop esophageal stricture. They are profoundly light sensitive for 30 days, such that they can't stick their hand out the window without getting burned. But it works, and it eliminates high-grade dysplasia in about 75% of patients. It's the only ablative therapy that's clearly shown to reduce cancer risk, and it's been shown to be roughly equivalent to esophagectomy. It happens to be as expensive as an esophagectomy, but it works. Morbidity is less than, let's say, that of an esophagectomy, where if you survive an esophagectomy, you're never quite the same.
Now, you did say, though, that stricture is a distinct possibility.
Right. One-third to half of patients treated with PDT will get a stricture.
That gets dilated in most people
right.
successfully?
Yes. So it's treatable, but requires multiple post-procedure interventions to get them swallowing again.
Okay, well, there must be a better way.
Yes, and that's how I got involved in what I do. So what are the other ways? There's a thing called EMR, endoscopic mucosal resection, that's snaring tissue off the lining of the esophagus. There's radiofrequency ablation, currently called Barex. That's a company that does that. And then there's the technique that I developed and invented called cryospray ablation. And that technique uses liquid nitrogen sprayed through a very small catheter, about 7 French, so about 2 to 3 millimeters in diameter, which is passed through a regular endoscope. And then what we do is we spray liquid nitrogen in a gas form and freeze the lining of the esophagus. Just like a dermatologist freezes a skin cancer, just like a gynecologist used to freeze dysplasia in the cervix, almost identical. We just spray the liquid nitrogen on the lining of the esophagus. As it turns out, that freezing will result in blistering about 2 to 3 days later. And then if you let that area heal in an environment with no acid, with a proton pump inhibitor like Nexium or Prilosec, in the majority of cases, the Barrett's will be gone. And if there's dysplasia, that will be gone as well. And we've now had quite a bit of experience even with early esophageal cancers and palliation of very advanced cancers. So cryospray ablation works for Barrett's, Barrett's with dysplasia, and Barrett's with early cancer, and even squamous cell cancer.
Now, I know that cryotherapy induces certain unique cellular changes, which is probably one of the reasons that you're able to use it in this broad spectrum
right.
of diseases. What is unique about the cellular reaction to a cryoablation therapy?
That's a great question, because of all the ablation techniques, basically you destroy tissue. Whether you snare it off with electric snare, whether you laser it, whether you take a hot poker with a thing called radiofrequency ablation, you burn off the tissue. Cryo is different in that you don't burn off the tissue. What you do is you shock it by freezing it. And as it turns out, freezing cells can induce this thing called apoptosis. And as it turns out, in Barrett's esophagus and in most cancers, one of the early abnormalities of a cancer is failure of a genetically damaged cell to undergo apoptosis.
Now, let me just interject.
So what is that?
Apoptosis
yeah.
is generally described as programmed cell death.
Exactly right. That is the textbook definition. So our cells are engineered in such a way that if a cell accumulates enough genetic damage, it will actually commit suicide. And that's called programmed cell death. And the medical term for programmed cell death is apoptosis. Cancer cells lose the ability to undergo apoptosis, and that's why they wreak the havoc that they do through our bodies. As it turns out, cryo, or freezing, of cancerous cells, and even Barrett cells that are not yet cancer, induces apoptosis. It's a really exciting association of why this works. And what we've found, interestingly, is you can take Barrett's that has high-grade dysplasia in it, and you can freeze it, and the Barrett's can still be there, but the high-grade dysplasia is gone when you go back and rebiopsy it. So in about 75 to 80% of cases that we treat, we can get completely rid of the Barrett's, but we find we can get rid of the dysplasia in almost everyone. And our current rate is over 90%.
Now, we in cardiac surgery use cryoprobes to freeze certain parts of the atrium when we're doing surgery for atrial fibrillation. We interrupt the pathways
right.
of conduction that perpetuate the atrial fibrillation. And we used to cut along those lines, but now we use a cryoprobe. But that is a very cold probe
right.
that kills by contact,
right.
not by spraying liquid nitrogen, which we wouldn't want rolling around inside the heart.
Right.
Even in the empty heart on cardiopulmonary bypass. Now, why do you use sprayed nitrogen instead of a probe and contact?
Contact probes were used in the 60s, and the most important thing is that when you endoscopically look at Barrett's, often the Barrett's is not a very distinct location. The advantage of spray is that you can literally observe exactly what you're treating. So you might treat an area over here, and then an area over there. And so the scope is down there. You can watch and treat exactly what you want to treat and skip what you don't want to treat. So the other thing is that when you have contact, that turns out to actually be a disadvantage when you're doing endoscopy. If you take a probe and it has direct contact with the tissue, it's stuck, and it can't be removed until it's warmed.
Right. Yeah.
With spray, you can continue to direct the spray wherever you want it and move the scope wherever you want it because there's been no contact with the mucosa. So a spray turns out to be a very unique advantage as opposed to taking a probe and making contact with the abnormal tissue.
You developed this technique, you patented it, you're using it.
Right.
People are going to immediately want to know, are you profiting from it?
Not at all. And it's a great story, but we don't have the time for it. I was the only investigator in the country at a time doing this. I started many years just doing the initial research in pigs. And as we discovered, the first prototype was actually developed in my garage with a special thermos compressor and some special epoxy resins that I got at a local hardware store that could handle temperature extremes. And once I had treated the first several pigs, we realized we were onto something that actually had some promise. And I was in Washington, D.C. at the time. A naval officer completely owned by the U.S. government, being a naval officer. And a friend of mine who was a researcher at Walter Reed said, oh my goodness, you need to patent this. There's nothing like this around. We did extensive literature search and found out no one had ever sprayed liquid nitrogen through an endoscope or into the GI tract ever. It's never been reported. And so belonging to the Navy, I had to go through a formal process called a determination of rights. And after a long, thorough process, the Navy determined that I was given permission to actually pursue patenting. So I began to pursue patenting on my own, and the Navy said the only proviso was that if it's ever patented and ever marketed, and the Navy chose to develop the device themselves, they would be able to develop it on their own and not owe me royalties. I developed the device, then established a relationship with a company that was interested in exploiting this technology and continued the research. So I came back to the Navy and said, I've been doing this research for now 5 years. Clearly there's a conflict of interest. I'm entitled to royalties. I would like guidance about addressing this conflict of interest. And the Navy acted all surprised, even though this had all been above the board, and they said, oh my goodness, we don't tolerate conflicts of interest. We eliminate conflicts of interest. So they decided there's no management of conflict of interest, and they gave me an ultimatum. And the ultimatum was, you may keep the royalties for the rest of your life, but if you do, you can never be the investigator, ever, in any way, shape, or form. Or you can continue to be the investigator, but you need to permanently divest yourself from any financial interests for the rest of your life. And that means no family member, a true divestment. I went home and I really agonized over that choice because the technology was in its infancy, and when you have something like that, it takes a lot of passion and enthusiasm and just kind of guts to see it go forward. And I knew that it was too early for it to take off on its own. So I actually decided to divest myself. Ultimately, what we did is we created a foundation. It's called the Johnston's Hope Foundation. And it's a 501(c) IRS approved charity. This is a charity devoted to third world medical missions. So all the royalties go to the Johnson's Hope Foundation, which in turn supports third world medical missions. And actually our charity did its first major mission. We took the technology to Kenya this summer in August, and we treated the first squamous cell carcinoma patients in the world, actually a series of them, with cryoablation. They were all stage 4 and fairly advanced disease.
They have a lot of esophageal cancer there.
Right. There's three squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus belts in the world, Kenya, China, and Iran. And in Kenya, you can see people that are 20 and 30 years old with stage 4 squamous cell carcinoma esophagus.
It's just genetic.
Probably a combination of genetic and dietary, a whole host of things, but clearly genetic when you see it that young. And so we took this technology to a cardiothoracic surgeon, a guy named Russ White, who's just an American who's devoted his life to working in Kenya and has seen more esophageal cancer than any American, put over 700 esophageal stents in just the last few years he's been there, which is phenomenal. And we started treating squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus under a research protocol approved by the Kenyan government this August. So, and that was the beginning of the Johnson's Hope Foundation sharing its royalties and spreading the technology.
Has this been approved by the FDA for anyone else to use? Is anyone else using it?
As it turns out, we received FDA approval for this in May of 2004. So it's been approved for 4 years. It's approved for a very wide use. It's approved for ablation in the GI tract endoscopically. So you can use it for quite a host of things, not just in the esophagus, not just for Barrett's. We now have this technology deployed to 35 major centers. We deployed it mainly to academic centers. So for example, it's at Mass General, it's at the Mayo Clinic, it's at the Cleveland Clinic, it's in California. We went to major cancer centers, Moffitt Cancer Center, Fox Chase Cancer Center, Thomas Jefferson University. So we took it to major medical centers with interest in Barrett's or cancer.
Now the one thing we didn't talk about were the complications, because you mentioned stricture after the photodynamic therapy. And what is the incidence of stricture after cryoablation therapy?
That's a great question, and it's important. Cryo is not risk-free. Whenever you intentionally damage tissue in the esophagus, there's risks. And the risks of cryo are esophageal stricturing, similar to the other ablation techniques. We think it's somewhere between 10% and 1 in 100. So 1 in 10 and 1 in 100. It falls somewhere in that window of risk. Fortunately, if a stricture occurs, it's easily treatable.
But they are dilatable.
Completely treatable as an outpatient via endoscopy. The other risks are perforation. That risk is probably 1 in 100, which is 1 in 100 is a high risk. But when you compare it to esophagectomy, that's tremendously preferable. And that risk is probably similar to the other things. And those are the two critical ones, stricturing and perforation.
What do we know about its effectiveness in preventing cancer? In other words, what is the incidence of cancer, if any, after cryoablation? We've already discussed the spontaneous development of cancer in people with Barrett's being somewhere between 5 and 10%. So
that's a great question, and the honest answer is it's too new of a technology to actually know its long-term impact on reducing cancer risk. So the right answer is we don't know yet. But we do have data from other ablation techniques. In fact, one just published last month in Gastrointestinal Endoscopy that demonstrated that ablation using PDT and EMR, that's endoscopic mucosal resection, has similar efficacy to esophagectomy. So we have early data in the field of ablation suggesting that ablation is just as effective when you're treating high-grade dysplasia and early cancer, that means early stage one cancer, as an esophagectomy.
So then my final question, which is what does the future hold? In a sense, you're already telling us that because we need to find out more about more people who have had this done.
I think the cryo is not for everyone. That's for sure. My personal conviction is that the niche that cryospray ablation fits in is the treatment of high-grade dysplasia in early esophageal cancer, like a stage 1, possibly T2 cancer. That's a pretty small niche, but it's an ideal treatment for that particular patient. It's significantly less morbid than esophagectomy. The other niche, I think this will really find the future of cryo, is palliation. We've already taken this to Kenya. It was very well tolerated in treating people with stage 4 non-resectable cancer. One of my first squamous cell carcinoma patients, which we published last year, was a gentleman who had recurrent squamous cell carcinoma of the esophagus, was no longer a radiation candidate, was no longer a candidate for surgery. And we palliated his T3, large recurrent squamous cell carcinoma for over 2 years. Actually had it completely go away and remained cancer-free for over 2 years before it came back. And so it has a tremendous promise, I think, in the palliation of people who have no other modality left. And we already have emerging data in that realm.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell us after this really tremendously thorough review of the subject?
Get your patients with heartburn screened for Barrett's, and we can take it from there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming to discuss that with us today.
Well, thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure.
That's all for this issue. Thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to being with you again in September.